Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, celebrating 70 years of service to financial advisors, their clients, and institutions worldwide. Details at putnam.com. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
By all rights, today should have been one of those days of economic gloom and doom. Another lousy housing report, consumer confidence up a tick, but still low, and Merrill Lynch with that $6 billion write-down. And yet, oil drops another couple of bucks and everybody's happy. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Angie's List, providing first-hand consumer reviews on local service like plumbers, painters, movers, and now doctors. Details at angieslist.com.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Good to have you with us on this Tuesday. It's the 29th of July. And here's what we had going into the working day today. A widely regarded real estate survey, the S&P Case-Shiller Index, showed home prices in May down by their biggest percentage ever, and consumer confidence still at a 16-year low. Fairly foreboding, no? But let me tell you how business journalists, at least the ones that work around here, wrapped up our day yesterday by remarking how interesting it was that after a 10% slide in its stock price Monday, Merrill Lynch conveniently waited until after the closing bell to drop its $5.7 billion bombshell. Our senior business correspondent Bob Moon reports timing is everything.
Like a lot of diehard home sellers still determined to get something closer to their asking price, Merrill Lynch has held out month after month. The financial giant has hoped to sell off its mountain of shaky loans since the real estate market began crumbling. And Merrill Chief John Thain has done his best to reassure shareholders that things should improve ever since he spoke to analysts during a conference call in January.
We're optimistic that as the market starts to open up and actually trades really occur, that we can actually sell these things at or near where they're marked. I hope we do, in fact, see some trading happen.
Now, Merrill Lynch has finally given up waiting. University of Maryland finance professor Peter Morisi says the big bank is cutting its losses and selling what little value is left in the loan portfolio.
$31 billion worth of subprime paper for only $7 billion. That's an enormous loss. And it's going to dilute its common stock 38% by selling new shares to make up the losses.
That stock sale is aimed at raising $8.5 billion, less than 2 weeks after Thain suggested in yet another conference call that the company was flush with cash.
We have a record level of liquidity, $92 billion in our liquidity pool. Right now, we believe that we are in a very comfortable spot in terms of our capital.
Professor Morisi says Thain has a credibility problem.
Now, investors can only ask, what else is there?
Maybe so, but Wall Street did seem relieved that Merrill is finally purging these shaky loans. Its stock gained 8% today. I'm Bob Moon for Marketplace.
Tight credit on Wall Street's one thing. It's entirely another when it starts to hit consumers where it hurts. College students in Massachusetts might wish they had more time before classes start this fall so that they can find the money to pay tuition. A major nonprofit lender in the Bay State has announced it's not going to be able to make student loans this fall. That's sending 40,000 families scrambling to find other options. From WBUR in Boston, Kurt Nickisch reports.
The Massachusetts Educational Financing Authority is a state-run lender that relies on credit markets for funds. Last year, it issued more than $500 million in student loans. But this year, Director Tom Graff says he couldn't wrangle financing and finally had to break the bad news to parents.
Yeah, a lot of schools, they need to satisfy their bill in late July and early August.
That's like today. Jim Tilby, a pastor from Raynham, Massachusetts, had been counting on the low-cost loans for his two college-bound kids.
I didn't really think it was going to be a problem, so I didn't have a lot of anxiety about it until today when I heard the news. It's there now.
Now Tilby's applying to the federal government and private banks. The loan terms won't be as good, but those institutions at least have their own money and don't have to rely as much on credit markets. Still, Tufts University financial aid director Pat Riley's afraid the last-minute scramble will lead to some bad decisions.
If you watch MTV at 2 o'clock in the morning, there's a lot of ads for student loans.
Students won't exactly be able to get their money for nothing there. Those loans often have terrible terms. A lot of kids are now getting a real education before they even set foot on campus. In Boston, I'm Kurt Nickisch for Marketplace.
The longest-serving Republican member of the United States Senate, Alaska's Ted Stevens, was indicted by a federal grand jury today. The indictment's part of a wide-ranging bribery investigation into VECO. That's a privately held oil services company, and its CEO, Bill Allen. From Washington, Marketplace's Steve Henn reports.
Senator Stevens is accused of hiding more than $250,000 in gifts he received from an Alaskan oil industry executive. Matthew Friedrich at the Justice Department said Bill Allen, former CEO of VECO, had employees there do hundreds of thousands of dollars of work on Stevens' house at an Alaskan ski resort.
VECO and its employees and contractors provided architectural designs for the renovation, assisted in lifting up the residence and installing a new first floor, installed electrical, plumbing, framing, heating, and flooring materials.
Not to mention the wraparound deck, and all for free. Allen also allegedly gave Stevens a professional Viking gas grill and traded a new Land Rover for an old Ford Mustang. At the same time, Stevens allegedly helped Allen land federal grants and funding for international business deals. Stevens' office had no immediate comment, but he isn't accused of accepting bribes. Instead, he will stand trial only for not listing these gifts on his personal financial disclosure forms. Stan Brand is a Washington ethics attorney.
It's a lot easier to prove false statements than it is to prove a bribe, because the level of proof required of a bribe, you would have to show evidence that he intended to take these gifts in connection with some official duty.
But to win this case, federal prosecutors just have to prove Stevens knowingly took these gifts without reporting them. In Washington, I'm Steve Henn for Marketplace.
Just as we were going to air, Senator Stevens did release a statement. He says he is innocent of the charges in the indictment today, and he intends to prove it. Oil hit $120 a share today. Equity investors started buying. We will have the details when we do the numbers. It seems trade officials meeting in Geneva this week didn't get the memo about globalization being the economic buzzword. The most recent round of World Trade Organization negotiations ended in disarray today without coming to agreement on some key issues. Marketplace's Stephen Beard's on the line from London. Hello, Stephen.
Hello, Kai.
It's been a long time since these talks started, 6 or 7 years. Remind us what they were about in the first place, would you?
Well, this is the Doha round, which, as you say, began 7 years ago in the Qatari city of Doha. And this was called the development round, designed to help the developing world. Basically, three elements here. Rich countries supposed to cut their farm subsidies so that farmers in poor countries can compete. Poor countries supposed to open up their markets to more industrial goods from the developed world, and a big shake-up in the service sector, so less restrictions on the movement of skilled workers around the globe. That was the plan, which appears to have finally collapsed amid a great deal of acrimony in Geneva today.
Well, what happened? Because there was progress in some areas, wasn't there?
Yes, I mean, what seems to have happened is that the U.S. fell out with China and India. In other words, the world's biggest economy fell out with two of the world's fastest growing emerging economies. They fell out over the issue of farm import rules. China and India wanted to be able to protect their farmers from foreign competition by raising tariffs on farm imports if there was a sudden surge of imports or if the price of those imports fell. And now, those safeguards actually already exist under the current rules, but the argument has been about how much those tariffs should go up. The U.S. says that what China and India have been calling for is too much. It's protectionism.
Does ended without agreement, as I mentioned in the introduction, really mean collapsed? I mean, are they done?
Well, one has to be wary about this because Doha has collapsed so often in the past and yet somehow struggled back onto its feet again. Its condition does look pretty terminal because of the timetable. We've got August looming now. The negotiators will be heading off for the beach. We've got, after the summer, the US preoccupied with the presidential election. The general view is that there's not going to be much appetite to revive these talks until next year, by which time, of course, there'll be a new U.S. government in power. And the fear is that the whole global economic climate may have darkened even further. And by then, the major players will be even less willing to make concessions.
Well, if the global economy has moved past this round of negotiations, does it matter then that Doha has ended without agreement?
Well, there are two schools of thought here. I mean, the worst case scenario is that the world will now lurch into a new era of protectionism. But that is the apocalyptic view. I mean, what certainly is true is that the existing trade liberalization rules won't disappear overnight. They're still there in place. We could well carry on as we are. But there is a danger that some big trading players may abandon the multilateral approach and start doing deals with each other. That will mean, undoubtedly, that smaller, poorer countries could lose out.
Marketplace's Stephen Beard at the European Desk in London. Thank you, Stephen.
Thank you, Kai.
No matter what the global economy is doing, summer can be a good time to catch up on your reading, whether you're relaxing at the beach or lazing around closer to home. In that spirit, we've got some suggestions for you again this year. Our annual series, Marketplace Beach Reads, is back this week with nominations from some of our regular commentators. Today, writer Carrie Jacobs introduces us to one of her favorite characters of fiction, one whose job it is to navigate the brand-obsessed world of market research.
I read William Gibson's 2003 novel, Pattern Recognition, when it first came out. Its heroine, Case Pollard, got stuck in my head like an old Bee Gees song. Years later, roaring down Sheikh Zayed Road in a Dubai taxi or wandering the neon-saturated streets of Tokyo's Shinjuku, I find myself wondering what Case Pollard would think if she were here. Case is a professional cool hunter. She's hired by a Machiavellian advertising mogul to search for the origins of some mysterious film snippets that are released one by one on the internet. Trouble ensues. But what actually drives the narrative is Case's acute sensitivity to corporate identity. She's literally allergic to certain logos. The Michelin Man, for example, makes her physically ill. The result is the most finely observed and entertaining text on branding that's ever been written. Here's Case in Harvey Nichols, the fashionable London department store. My God, don't they know? This stuff is simulacra of simulacra of simulacra. A diluted tincture of Ralph Lauren, who had himself diluted the glory days of Brooks Brothers, who themselves had stepped on the product of Jermyn Street and Savile Row. But Tommy, surely, is the null point, the black hole. There must be some Tommy Hilfiger event horizon beyond which it is impossible to be more derivative, more removed from the source, and more devoid of soul. Pattern Recognition's Case lives every day, as most of us do, in a world of pure media. I still keep her in my head because she's an excellent tour guide. She leads me with eyes wide open through the present moment, in which there's no escaping the simulacra of simulacra of simulacra.
Carrie Jacobs is a writer. She lives in Brooklyn. Listener Brenna Bachowski lives in Carroll Stream, Illinois. She recommends A History of the World in Six Glasses. It's from Economist Magazine's technology editor, Tom Standage. It charts the history of our favorite drinks, everything from the ancient origins of wine to modern-day coffee houses. If you've got a book you want to tell us about, go to our website. It's marketplace.org, of course. Click on that link that says Best Marketplace Beach Reads.
I'm going to sit right down and write myself a letter.
Two stories in particular resonated with listeners over the past couple of weeks. Many of you wrote, with brows knitted, no doubt, about our story on yarn stores struggling in the down economy. Pat Kirtland's owned the Yarn Barn in Andersonville, Virginia, for 37 years.
Our industry is great in a weak economy. More people are staying home and want something to do. With the cost of heating homes this winter, this is a perfect time to get those needles clicking so they can set the thermostat down and be comfy this winter.
But if you want to hang that knit garment up to dry, you'll probably have to find a spot inside. We told you last week about the American ambitions of an Australian company that makes clotheslines. They're used all over the place down under, apparently. But the company's U.S. marketing campaign could run into trouble because a lot of homeowners associations here don't typically like the look of blue jeans and unmentionables flapping in the wind. Carol Press of Menlo Park, California, spoke for the overwhelming majority of you who just couldn't understand objections to an outdoor clothesline.
Is there anything nicer than getting into a freshly made bed with line-dried sheets? The smell is wonderful. I moved here from Ireland 8 years ago and still cannot understand why Americans do not make use of the free sunshine to line dry their laundry.
A quick fix to point out this week, in our report on racing executive Max Mosley's fight with British tabloids, we identified him as the Formula One boss. He gets called that a lot, but Formula One's actually the racing league. Mosley's official title is president of the FIA. That's the French acronym for Formula One's governing body. We use some sound in that piece that irked F1 purists, too.
Helen, start your engine.
That's really more Indy 500 than Monaco Grand Prix. This is the start of an F1 race. So if something revs you up, drop us a line at our website. It's marketplace.org. Click on the link that says contact. Coming up, fishing for deals on wild salmon.
You'll see Scottish organic salmon. And so people are drawn to that, like, oh, I like to eat organic. It doesn't say on the menu that it's farmed.
But first, let's do the numbers. This is a familiar pattern. Oil down, markets up. The Dow Industrials soared 2.3% today, 266 points to close at 11,397. The NASDAQ shot up 2.4%, 55 points, 23.19 at the bell. The S&P 500 rose 2.3%, 28 points, ended at 1263. Crude oil settled at a three-month low, around $122 a barrel. That was good news for airlines, believe you me. Delta, American Airlines, that's AMR to you. And United, that's UAL, by the way. All gained serious altitude. Shares in the three carriers lodged double-digit increases. Bond prices fell. The yield on the 10-year T-note rose to 4.04%. And you are listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Gather.com, where friends keep up with the people, conversations, and moments that matter most. People are talking about business at Gather.com. Marketplace aims to be insightful and provocative. And if you send our stories along, you can be too. Log on to our website and forward any story you hear. Every day's rundown is there, along with transcripts of the show and links to individual pieces. It's at marketplace.org.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Wednesday. On Capitol Hill, the Joint Economic Committee holds a hearing on how energy efficiency can help strengthen our economy. The House Budget Committee addresses the issue of rising food prices. And the AARP Foundation hosts a symposium on poverty and aging in America. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdal. There has been no shortage of natural disasters out here in California today. There is not much serious damage from that 5.4 earthquake that hit Los Angeles earlier. But up north near Yosemite National Park, it's a very different story. There, a wildfire has destroyed 25 homes and burned more than 29,000 acres. Officials say it's about 15% contained. But a series running in the Los Angeles Times this week points out that the costs of fighting those fires often aren't contained at all. Times reporters Julie Carton and Bettina Boxall have been working on the series for a year now. Welcome to the program.
Pleasure to be with
you.
Our
pleasure.
Bettina, when we start thinking about fires, obviously one of the things that comes to mind is how much we're paying to fight them. What is the dollar amount?
The Forest Service last year spent $1.3 billion on fire suppression. The state of California spent about $1 billion.
Put that into context for me, though. 10 years ago, how much were we spending?
10 years ago, the Forest Service spent $307 million, so it's spending $1 billion more now.
Julie, where are all those bills coming from? I mean, it's an extra $1 billion is a whole lot of money.
A lot more fires, a lot bigger fires. For the most part, there has been more than a decade effort to privatize federal government, and that has certainly found its way into firefighting. The bills are coming from private industry.
Private industry, contractors out there fighting fires.
You bet.
In what form? I mean, are they the actual firefighters in addition to support personnel?
They are the actual firefighters in certain parts of the country. In the Pacific Northwest, incident commanders told us that as many as 90% of the firefighters on the line were from private companies. The trend in other states is less to private firefighters, but all the services, food, sanitation, et cetera, and then helicopters, air tankers, engines.
Bettina, what are those camps like? I mean, when you're out there fighting a fire, do you get the creature comforts from home, too?
You certainly do. They become very elaborate and very sophisticated. I mean, basically, they're transporting high-tech villages to the edge of fires, and they come equipped with air-conditioned office trailers, with Wi-Fi and shredders and copy machines. There are shower trailers, mobile kitchens, a caterer who caters movie shoots also caters big fires. So they are not primitive operations anymore at all.
Julie, the Forest Service will say, listen, it makes much more sense for us to contract these camps out rather than to invest in the infrastructure to keep them 365 days a year when we're only out there fighting fires for a couple of months in the late summer and fall.
They do say that. And I could understand that they wouldn't want to buy ice chests and sleeping tents and things like that. But we focused on a fire called the Zaca Fire, which was the biggest fire no one ever heard of that happened in Santa Barbara last summer, where there's a briefing tent for internal briefings that is they're paying nearly $1,000 a day for a four-month fire. I mean, that's a lot of dough. So you could say, oh, you nickel-dime, but it really adds up to the fire that we looked at in particular, more than $140 million for a fire that burned a shed.
Bettina, would we be having this conversation if we weren't seeing these big fires on CNN and statewide newscasts?
Well, they would still be spending a lot of money on fires because they are getting bigger and more people are living in fire-prone areas, and so more and more homes are threatened. I think one thing that we found was that the CNN and publicity was influencing the use of aviation.
The big tankers and helicopters.
The big tankers and the big helicopters, because that's very much become equated in the public mind with putting out a fire. And if you don't have those in use, then people think, you're not really putting out the fire that's burning in my backyard.
I've always wondered, though, how much dropping 5,000 gallons of water on a raging forest fire across 10,000 acres will actually do.
Sometimes it does good, and sometimes it's a complete waste of effort and time and money. It neither retardant nor water put out fires. Is all they can do is slow it.
What we're seeing now, actually, with the rising cost of these fires is the end result of years of government policy being we have to put out all these fires.
In part. It's actually more complex than that. There are other elements at work, too. In the Great Basin area, there are invasive species that are causing huge fires that are burning hundreds of thousands of acres every year. And the encroachment of development has complicated fires. And houses are fuel. I mean, when you build a bunch of houses next to a wildland, you're basically adding fuel to the landscape. So it's a host of factors, many of which we created ourselves. It is no single thing.
Julie Cart and Bettina Boxall from the Los Angeles Times. Thanks very much for coming in.
Pleasure.
Thank you.
The Japanese fishing industry got some relief from high fuel prices today, along with a stern talking to. The government in Tokyo says it'll subsidize some fuel costs, but in return, fishermen have to promise to figure out a way to use less of it. Energy prices are hitting American fishing fleets, too. For the wild salmon fisheries along the Pacific coast, it's just adding to a whole host of problems. Salmon runs in West Coast rivers are dwindling due to agriculture, hydropower, and urban development. The fleet's completely shut down from the Mexican border up to the Oregon coast, which means prices are up, too, and consumers are shopping around. From Newport, Oregon, Mitchell Hartman reports.
The scene at Oregon's biggest commercial fishing port is postcard perfect, except the salmon boats have been sitting idle at anchor all season. And that's a problem for Laura Anderson. She owns Local Ocean Seafoods, an open-air fish market and restaurant right across from the jetty. Wild salmon caught in nearby waters is usually the specialty of the house, but because the boats aren't fishing, she doesn't have anything local to offer. Instead, she has a single cut of premium Chinook caught much further north near the Canadian border.
This product is $29.50 a pound right now, which is a pretty good price considering a lot of wild salmon in the marketplace is over $30. 5 years ago, it probably would have been about $14 a pound.
100 miles away, in Portland, Richard Knudsen oversees the seafood counter at New Seasons Market. It's an upscale local grocery chain. Knudsen says he's got wild salmon for sale, but it's all coming from Alaska, and it's expensive.
Fuel prices are a huge issue with the salmon.
Knudsen says as a barrel of oil goes up in price, so does a pound of fish.
Boats are not going out unless they know they can catch full loads of seafood. It's harder to book flights to get them sent here, and also the transportation issues for the trucks to bring them to us are, you know, it's just getting out of hand.
Retailers try to push cheaper, more plentiful fish like ling cod, tuna, and halibut, but Knudsen says it's hard to teach consumers new tricks.
Salmon is a very hard fish to substitute for. Our meat and seafood merchandisers have been trying to bring in more sustainable salmon, less fished, like Kita, chum, pink salmon.
Chum, isn't that the stuff that usually ends up in a can? But at comparatively bargain prices, Knudsen says shoppers are beginning to try it. Some customers may be tempted to switch to farmed salmon. It's readily available despite health and environmental concerns. But diners may not necessarily know what they're getting. Chef Diane Morgan is the author of Salmon, a Cookbook. She's noticed a bit of bait and switch at high-end restaurants lately.
You'll see Scottish organic salmon. And so people are drawn to that, like, oh, I like to eat organic. It doesn't say on the menu that it's farmed. If you know enough about this industry, you know that any salmon coming out of the Atlantic is farmed.
At the upscale New Seasons Market, the farmed stuff isn't even on offer. Customer Leslie Davis is a Portland local, and she's still hooked on wild salmon. But the high prices have forced her to adjust her shopping list.
I'm eating a lot more chicken thighs and having a lot more vegetarian meals.
And at what price would you simply walk away from the salmon, do you think?
Oh, I don't know if there's a price I'd walk away from salmon. Salmon is so good. I suppose $20 a pound, I'd really have to look at something else to eat.
Davis has purchased today steaks of budget wild sockeye at the bargain price of $14.99 a pound, so she's still got a little wiggle room. In Portland, I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, offering more of what you want in a retirement plan. Putnam Investments, a prudent approach to investing. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
This final note today, I guess it's really a roundup of businesses gone bust. Food first. The restaurant chains Bennigan's and Steak and Ale filed for Chapter 7 bankruptcy protection today. Seven's the one where you shut things down and start selling off your assets right away. Both the chains are owned by Metro Media Restaurant Group. They're based in Plano, Texas. Also, retail, the 59-year-old Mervyn's department store chain based out here in California, they filed for Chapter 11 today. That's the one that lets you reorganize and try to give it another go. And that is Marketplace from American Public Media on this Tuesday. Today, the Dow rose 266 points, 2.3%. NASDAQ gained 55 points, 2.4%. The S&P 500 added 28 points. That's 2.3% there. Thanks to Jennifer Collins and Doug Krisner on our Morning Report crew. The Marketplace Morning Report is produced by John Buckley. Coming up next time on this program, a slow economy revs up a love for fast food.
Probably 5 years ago, if you admitted to somebody you went to McDonald's or Burger King to eat, you'd probably be embarrassed, or you wouldn't admit it because it was so bad. Now it's not the same anymore.
I'm Kai Rizdahl. Hope you can join us for that tomorrow.
American Public Media.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.